are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
Yes, it is Thursday night. It is 9 p.m. My name is Russ McKenzie. You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. I'm joined now by Tyler Bailey and Matt Pollard. It's funny that we bring the two of you on tonight. Matt being the LA Galaxy reporter for us at Last Word Soccer Club, and Tyler Bailey, who covers the lowly, very expensive New York City FC.
Russ,
with the most expensive mascot in all of sports.
Russ, I'd like to think that our longtime listeners are aware that even if my team is insufferable to the listeners as a fan and as a reporter of them, I am not. I try to look at the Galaxy objectively and find, and if anything, I'm almost harder on them to dispel any notions that I am biased towards them.
And hey, nothing like a little self-deprecation on the other side, right? Because that is my attitude towards NYCFC for the most part.
Are you okay? Do you need to talk about things?
It's been tough, you know?
Do you need a hug?
No, I don't.
Okay,
preferably from somebody on this side of the country. Right, yeah, that would be nice, right?
Okay.
Since I'm the closest to your tie, geography-wise, I'll volunteer for the hug.
All right. Okay. You know, whenever you can make that, I guess.
Anyway, we're looking down the barrel of another Major League Soccer rivalry week with a bunch of great games on tap for you. The one with the most repercussions, the most important to either team is going to be this Atlantic Cup game on Sunday. Between New York Red Bulls and DC United. That could ridiculous things notwithstanding going on in Chicago. I think that it's very important for, very important for the Red Bulls to win that, simply to, keep their hopes of being number one in the Eastern Conference alive.
Absolutely, Russ, and I think I look at it on the other side with DC. Yeah, they've gotten two wins against lowly competition in CCL group play, but they haven't looked good in MLS play either. So I think these are both two teams coming in looking to not only get off the schneid, but certainly cement their place at the top of the Eastern Conference. And, I tweeted this out, and I tagged you and Alec in the tweet earlier this week. I think this game very well could ultimately, at the end of the season, decide who walks away with the number one seed in the East.
I would totally support that statement 100%. I think that
what is the season series right now? Is it 1-1?
It's 1-0-1.
The Red Bull.
Well, yeah, Red Bulls won at Red Bull Arena at the home opener, and
yes,
then they tied in DC. They drew in DC. It was a last-minute type of thing, too. The DC was up, and the Red Bulls came back to tie it. It's definitely a series with more historical bite as well. These two teams have been, told that their marketing is the MLS as Major League Soccer's oldest rivalry. Not LA Galaxy, San Jose Earthquakes notwithstanding.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's happening this weekend too. And, I think that might be just as important, if not as, a little bit more important than the DC, Red Bulls rivalry, only because there are not only, playoff implications on both sides. LA is looking at a supporter shield, chance of their own maybe, but San Jose suddenly putting together a run where if they win a few games, they could end up in the playoffs. And a few weeks ago, we were, you know, counting them off as pretty dead in the water.
Mm-hmm. Ty, I don't know that it's more. I don't know that tomorrow night's Cali Classico is going to be as critical to the end of the season as the Atlantic Cup, but I do say that this is a very critical game for the San Jose Earthquakes in the hopes of actually making the playoffs. So I'm not going to, you know, point this as a must win for the Goonies per se, but if there's any individual game of those four teams playing this weekend that needs a win, it's definitely San Jose. And I think Bruce Arena and company are very much going to have their hands full. We can talk about predictions later, but Chris Wondolowski and company are not going away quietly this year.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. But you look at LA once again, and here they are suddenly competing for another supporter shield out of nowhere. I mean, that's a team that's had its midseason additions come together beautifully where a lot of teams haven't. But, you know, DC and the Red Bulls obviously both looking at maybe not just 1 and 2 in the East, but also a supporter shield of their own. I feel like both of these have a lot of clout as far as the rest of the season goes.
You know, it's funny with San Jose. They've come a long way since the beginning of the season. I mean, they had a lot of new parts come in, and really, it's been kind of an uphill battle for them. And then all of a sudden, they're putting this run together. I'm not totally sold. I may be the only person who's not totally sold on the San Jose Earthquakes being for real. I think that they're going to cool off. I do. I think that at some point they're going to cool off, and I think that cooling off is going to start playing LA on the weekend.
What is that, Russ McKenzie? Are you seriously? Yes, it is tomorrow night. Yeah. On God forbid MLSSAP. But Russ, are you serious? Are you doubting a Dominic Kinnear coach team at the end of the season?
Bread and butter, man.
I know that. I understand that, and I'm not saying that they're not going to make the playoffs. I'm saying that they're not going to go real far.
Oh no, I think making the wild card is a good result for them. I think getting into the playoffs, I think that's certainly plausible. I think they can do it. I think anything after that will be gravy and over exceeding expectations.
Yeah. No. I'm just not sold on them.
They're not a contender for sure.
No.
But they're a contender for a playoff spot. They're not a contender in the playoffs at all, I don't think.
Especially not in the West.
This is Major League Soccer, and it has been known to get pretty weird at times. But even then, I don't see them going far if they get in. But as far as, you know, those teams cannibalizing each other in the West, those 3rd through 6th spots, Seattle dropping out, San Jose, they do have a good shot of making it in.
You know, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking to you just mentioned Seattle, and they also are part of MLS Rivalry Week, of course. Who are they playing, Russ? Oh, they're playing the Portland Timbers. Yeah, I do. You have Seattle playing Portland, and you know, to hear Seattle Sounders fans talk about it, they invented Rivalry Week. But, you know, it's Portland on the road. Portland has not traditionally done real well on the road. Guys, what do you think? I mean, this is the one that's a toss-up to me. I think clearly you're going to see the Red Bulls win in against DC. You're definitely going to see LA Galaxy, and I'm sorry, San Jose Earthquakes fans. I know some of you do actually listen, but LA has the best attack, quite possibly the best
in the history of the league.
They quite possibly have the best team that's ever been assembled in MLS.
And you have Clarence Goodson and Chris Wondolowski.
Yeah, it's all you need, really. Yeah. I mean, to be fair to them, if you look what they've done in the last, 8 days, they have 3 shutout victories. One was against Sporting Kansas City, which was a shock. One of them was against Colorado, so that doesn't really count. But the other one was against DC United. So, I mean, they're kind of giant killers at this point, which is unbelievable to me. Yeah. But I still don't see them beating LA.
Absolutely, Ty. But I think to your point of this is so MLS – at Kansas City, at Seattle, and at DC United, the San Jose Earthquakes have 4 wins in 4 games, which I think is an absolutely mind-boggling statistic. But to get back to your original question, Russ, I agree with you that Portland-Seattle is a toss-up, but I think the big headline for me on this one, it's put-up or shut-up time for the Seattle Sounders, to be honest. I know Deuce and Oba are finally getting back and getting healthy, but they did not play well against RSL in Utah the other weekend. And, you know, San Jose's creeping up on them. Houston's creeping up on them. Maybe Real Salt Lake, you know, other than Colorado, the three teams immediately below them are looking poised some level to do something, and Seattle needs points, and they need points on the road, you know, against teams that frankly have had a better season than them. Obviously they're going to be at home tonight, but I mean, you want to talk about a 6-pointer and also, you know, distancing yourself from the other teams in the back behind you. I think this is a very critical game for Seattle.
Oh, definitely. I think losing Alonso was too much for them to come back from now.
I'd see it. I kind of see it that way too. I think that there's going to be, again, I see Seattle winning this, but I don't see them making the playoffs. Is that sick? I don't even know what to make of that. If you had told me at the beginning, before this season had started, that Seattle was going to be struggling to keep the final seed in the playoffs, and that the Red Bulls were going to be, you know, fighting for first in the East,
I would have flipped those two. I would have had Seattle winning, you know, fighting for first in the West, and then the Red Bulls fighting for the last playoff spot in the East.
I did have them fighting for the last playoff spot in the East. you know, I actually had them fighting for the last playoff spot in the East with Orlando. But, you know, Orlando seems to have had the late season swoon, as it were.
Yeah, they're kind of the same story as far as that goes with Seattle. I mean, you've got a team that is pretty much completely decimated by injuries to key guys. And, I mean, knowing MLS and knowing the perennial depth issues that a lot of teams have, when you have things like that happen, it really, really derails your season, especially with Seattle. I mean, it's their top three guys, you know, like by some distance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think losing Oba for as long as they did, and just, you know, Clint Dempsey just not being able to get it going this year. I think part of it has to do with his poor performance for the U.S. men's national team. I mean, I hate to say that because it was literally a train wreck.
Clint's performance or the general team performance?
The general team performance. I think it got into his head a little bit, and he's trying to take on too much in Seattle right now. I wish I had a psychologist bed for all the players in Major League Soccer that have had, you know, problems when they shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Looking back on this season as a whole, and then now, you know, I was able to watch the past two or the past three Sounders CCL games, and I was very impressed with what Zach Scott was able to do with, you know, a relatively makeshift back line other than him. Was the Brad Evans center back idea a failure?
I don't think on the whole. In the beginning, I think you have to. To put it lightly, I think there were growing pains involved with that experiment. But I think as the season went on, you saw him, you know, pretty much true to form, be that Swiss Army knife that they needed. And I mean, of course, towards, you know, more recently, he's moved out of that center back spot a little bit, but He made some really good plays. You can't take that away from him. But, I mean, I think it's just a general lack of consistency, not only with him, but with their entire squad, between injuries and international call-ups and some suspensions that they had. more than just the Brad Evans experiment, I think that was what killed them. You can't have that many things go wrong in MLS and still hope to be, you know, the team that you are with a full squad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I agree with you on that. I think you know, Seattle's defense was an issue going back to last year. By the way, our phone number here, phone lines are open, 732-707-7994. Please give us a call and, you know, derail us accordingly. As far as Seattle's defense, that was a question before the season even began. That was a question last season. And in my opinion, last season they could have won MLS Cup if they had had, a better as good a defense, or even just a little bit better of a defense than what they had. And they didn't get better in the offseason. They didn't. So there it is.
Going into the offseason, they said, you know, if that ball by Juninho is 1 inch to the right, we're hosting MLS Cup. So I think Seattle took it as, we have the pieces in place, we just need to tinker a few things. You know, they picked up Roldan in the expansion draft. They added a few pieces to depth, you know, to account for the fact that S2 was coming in. And they figured, if we repeat what we did last year, we should be in a playoff spot late. Maybe if we keep up the form, we're in a contention for the Supporter Shield. And if we do exactly what we did, we'll be right where we are. And odds are we can probably win that game against LA and then go on and host an MLS Cup. And everything just fell off the wagon. I don't think that's the fault of any of the GMs. I don't think that's the fault of Garth Lagerwey coming over. That's certainly not. I think Siggy's done everything that he can to patch together this team with, you know, tape and with duct tape and hamster poop, and they're just barely holding on by a thread right now.
And honestly, that's gonna be the thing that's going to end up hurting them in the end the most. It's gonna be this lack of defense. And you know, you can go around the league and point to certain teams that haven't invested in defense and put all their proverbial eggs in one basket. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at teams like and Ty, I'm not gonna bring up City, I swear.
You should. They're a perfect example.
Well, all right. So I'm willing to give. This is on air, and this is getting recorded, so you can definitely keep me to this. I'm willing to give City a pass because they're an expansion team, and because they are playing in one of the biggest sports markets in the world.
Oh yeah, they're in put butts in seats mode,
right?
And it works. It's worked really well.
It has. Every Euro fan in the tri-state area has gone to see Pirlo be lazy and David Villa work his butt off and not have support around him, and Frank Lampard
necessito teammates
sits in the luxury box and see himself on the big screen. Okay.
Oh yeah, him and Beckham.
Yeah. Constantly. Anyway, so
Beckham,
I mean,
earned that box seat, Ty. He earned it.
There's
with
that.
His blood, sweat, and hair products.
And tattoos.
And tattoos.
Blood, sweat, and ink.
And his underwear ads. Don't forget the underwear ads.
Yes.
So,
how could you? How could you forget those?
Oh, there's something definitely wrong with us. So, you know, going. Look. Toronto's another perfect example. They spent all this money in attack, and even at the deadline, they had the perfect opportunity to go out and find themselves a center back that will support that will allow Bradley to do Bradley things against teams like the New York Red Bulls. But they went out and got Hercules Gomez. Now, I think part of that, looking at it now, I think part of that was to light a fire under Josie's ass.
Yep.
But I still,
and have a backup plan in case it doesn't work.
Well, I don't think it's working.
No, what I'm saying, okay, Josie failures, you have Hercules Gomez. That is a viable option up top with Giovinco in some aspect.
Last week against Orlando, a team which they absolutely demolished, they had three of the U.S. 2010 World Cup forwards starting that game on their bench. Fun little fact.
Now here's the other thing. Let's talk about Orlando for a second. Orlando is another example of a team that didn't spend a defense and is feeling the hurt now.
Well, they kind of did. They brought in Breck, and Breck's done a good job, but he's hurt now. He's out with that sports hernia, I think. And they've got Aurelien Collin, who's proven in this league. I mean, now he's proven that he sucks in this league. But he did win MLS Cup with Sporting Kansas City. They have Seb Hines. He's hurt, right? I think.
Yep.
So I mean that's not very good. But he was doing great. I mean they're in the beginning of the year they were so promising because their defense was playing so well. Even Rafael Ramos, you know, he's been great this year. I mean he's had some disciplinary issues. He's got two red cards now, so that doesn't help. But he's another young player that, you know, that's going to happen. But as a whole, that first choice back four they had was solid. Definitely a solid lineup.
Yeah, no, it was, and then all of a sudden depth.
Well, it's largely not even the same guys anymore. That's half the problem. Okay,
guys, I'm going to put this whole argument to bed. Russ,
bring it.
Who were the first two players that Bruce Arena drafted as head coach of the LA Galaxy?
Oh, God, I have no idea.
Omar Gonzalez and AJ De La Garza.
Well, there it is. They've been a pair ever since.
Look at what they do when they're both starting. Look at what they do statistically when they're both starting at center back, and look at the LA Galaxy's fortune since then. Now, Russ, who was Peter Vermes' first draft pick as the head coach of Sporting Kansas City?
Really, I don't know.
Was it Beasley?
Drop the mic.
There it is.
Sporting fit. He's been sporting fit forever.
Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're Jurgen Klinsmann, you don't think he's very fit.
It's not that he's not fit. It's just there are a few center backs ahead of him.
Ah, right. Yes, like there are a few attacking midfielders in front of the best attacking midfielder we have.
Yes.
They're all Germans.
Yep, they're all Germans. All right, guys, we're going to cut to break right here.
Wait, Russ, we don't want to do pick'ems on Rivalry Week?
Okay, let's do pick'ems.
Okay.
San
Jose, LA. LA Galaxy 2, San Jose Earthquakes 1.
LA Galaxy 3, San Jose Earthquakes 2.
I said 2-1 LA. I said 2-1 right. LA. What's what about DC Red Bulls, guys?
This is at Red Bull Arena?
Oh, yes.
Oh, man.
I'm going to say Red Bull 1-0. I think Bradley Wright Phillips gets it done.
Yeah? Okay. I said 2-1, and I also said that Sean Wright Phillips and Gonzalo Verón both start.
I'm going to go 2-1 Red Bulls. I think they're going to leave it late, and on the second goal, Sean Wright Phillips is going to assist Bradley Wright Phillips, and it's going to be a great story.
Again. All right, I have 2-1 Seattle, and my exact comment in the last word soccer club pick'em was Portland on the road. What else is there to say?
This is a tough one. Because Portland's been trash on the road, but Seattle is coming off a midweek trip to Honduras, and they suck in general. So I think I'm going to give the Timbers this one. I think it's going to be 1-0. I don't think Seattle generates anything.
And I'm going to complete the side of this triangle and say that while Portland has been bad on the road, I think they muster up enough energy against a weakened Seattle side. But the absence of Diego Chara due to a red card last week is going to hurt them, leaving us with a 2-2 draw in this Cascadia bout.
Okay. By the way, Last Word Soccer Club pick'em is going to be out tomorrow morning. Ahead, we picked the group of us have picked all three matches, which means this could be the deciding week. If somebody strikes pay dirt with all three matches, I'm currently not in the lead. That goes to Joseph Goldstein, my my colleague, my counterpart, covering New York Red Bulls for Last Word Soccer Club. Guys, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit of the Amway Canadian Championship, that game that went on last night, and the utter disaster that that turned into. Plus, we're going to cover some, you know, CONCACAF Champions League stuff. Of course, that's going on too. And as Matt so blatantly put it, obligatory weekly review of who the best team in Major League Soccer is.
We have to do it. We have not spoken about this enough.
So when we come back, phone lines are going to still be open, 732-707-7994. When we come back, only you're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. If I could find the music, this would help us greatly.
You away, swore up on the sun I'd save you for a rainy day. Loosen the noose, then let go of the rope. I know if it's never coming back, it has to go. I keep calling your name, babe. I wanna hold you close, but I never wanna feel ashamed. So I keep calling at night, babe. I wanna hold you close. Calling it off, calling it off, just to keep calling to your arms.
said, let's do it.
Let's.
Welcome back to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name is Russ McKenzie. Welcome back. Welcome back, Matt and Ty here. We're gonna jump right into it here and talk a little bit about the Canadian Championship last night, the deciding match between Vancouver Whitecaps and Montreal Impact. What the hell was Cabrera thinking?
Oh, man. Oh, man.
You know, by the way, if you haven't heard, Vancouver won that match. Was it 2-0?
2-0.
2-0. Yes. At BC Place, after both goals were scored, I believe, after the second yellow to Mr. Cabrera. The funny thing is, what really gets me about that is that first yellow was really weak. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a very strong yellow. And the second one definitely was a yellow card.
100%.
100%. I mean, hockey announcers would call that a lovely open ice hit, mm-hmm. a hip check even. So there it was. Montreal just can't buy a break, and unless they win, you know, the Eastern Conference, they're definitely not going to be able to get back to the Champions League. Unless they win MLS Cup, which I don't think is going to happen either. I don't even know. I kind of half watched the match earlier today.
He wasn't even
in the 18. So let's rewind it a little bit to last weekend, where Drogba did play and was an uncontrollable disappointment.
Yes, I didn't like what I saw from Drogba at all. Not like, you know, generally in his effectiveness, because, I mean, if you're a Montreal fan, he did do some things that got you some chances. But, I mean, just to see him flop around like a fish and call for cards after flopping around like a fish and generally not looking like he really genuinely cared about playing the match, you know, as it were. That's not a good thing to see if you're a fan of the league, if you're a fan of the Impact. But to be fair, at the same time, I think he has more minutes under his belt now than Frank Lampard, so that's a plus.
Oh, you wicked, wicked monkey! Look, as far as Drogba goes, you got to figure. I don't want to make excuses for the man because he did look pretty not good. It's his preseason. I mean, realistically, I don't know. I'm trying to make sense of it all here, and
whatever reasons for it, you know, whatever, even if they're like totally legitimate reasons. The bottom line is he didn't play well, and that's really all that counts. So if he wasn't ready, he shouldn't have played. If he was just going to, you know, go out and do that, he shouldn't have played. But he did, and it wasn't good, and I think that's really all there is to take away from it at this point in the season.
What do you think, Matt?
Going back to the actual question at hand, you know, I thought this was a gritty you know, after a gritty first leg where, you know, the teams were 2-2 at Stade Saputo in Montreal, they came home, and I honestly think that, you know, Montreal dressed a lineup that was akin to going on the road in a tough but winnable CCL group stage game and hoping you can luck out with a B-plus team and getting result. And really, Vancouver, I think, you know, Vancouver said that we're going to dress our first team. You know, other than Pamo Duca, I'm looking out here. It was pretty much all of the regular starters. Kakuta Yamane started. It was Morales and Rivero up top. Octavio Rivera gets the goal. Christian Teixeira, who's been excellent for them. And then Gershon Kofi and Ty Bird as holding midfielders. They came out and they said, we want our first trophy. We're winning this. And they went out, and that's exactly what they did. I think they came at Montreal early and often. I think that got into their heads where, you know, Simon and Cabrera get the unsportsmanlike conduct yellows, and then after that it was all downhill after the red card.
I would agree with that assessment. And, you know, Vancouver wins their chance to go to CONCACAF Champions League next year.
Mm-hmm. And as an MLS fan, isn't Vancouver the team, like, of the three Canadian teams we have right now in their current states, isn't Vancouver the one we want in Champions League? Aren't they the one best equipped for the tournament?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, I think if any MLS club right now is equipped for CONCACAF Champions League, it's going to be the LA Galaxy. Simply because they can deal with the Heat better than anybody around.
And they got the depth. They've got the depth for it for sure. But I think, you know,
Then, because the Amway Canadian Championship has to be one of the Canadian teams. So between Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver, isn't it not a landslide that Vancouver is the one best equipped for the Champions League?
No, they definitely are, because they too have the most depth among the Canadian teams. And, you know, on their front 11, they have the most dangerous players. I mean, except for obviously Toronto with Giovinco. But back to front, they have the most complete starting 11 of any of the three Canadian teams. So I think if you're going to go by that metric, they're still the most equipped team for CONCACAF Champions League.
And they not only that, they really kind of play the best ball of any of the most tactically sound soccer of any of the Canadian teams. You can't. Their midfield is deadly efficient when everything's clicking. By the way, phone lines are open 732-707-7994. We're talking Amway, the Amway Canadian Championship, and we're starting to leak into CONCACAF Champions League here. Guys, just looking at the results from CCL, Seattle not doing so hot last night, losing 1-0 in their match. Let's see what else we got.
And then DC was 3-0 against Montego Bay on the road. So DC United now 3 wins, I believe. Or no, this was at RFK Stadium. So 2 wins, 1 home, 1 away, and a +4 goal differential.
Not a bad start for them.
Not a bad start at all.
The Seattle match, I actually watched most of that game, and I do have to say, Seattle looked good when they had the ball, but, and this is a function of A, not having your first choice defensive midfielder even available to you, and B, not even you know, starting anywhere near to what your starting lineup would look like. But when they didn't have the ball, they were so unequipped to play defense against a surprisingly athletic Olympia side. But they did get absolutely screwed on an offside call early in the match that would have put them up 1-0. And I think that would have changed the whole game immediately. The guy, Lamar Nagel, was about 3 yards onside, and the referee called him off, and he would have had to tap it.
Well, that's CONCACAF.
That's CONCACAF.
#CONCACAF.
They got capped. That's payback for what happened in Seattle with that 98th minute penalty kick. That's fun. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, what was that? What was that about? I mean, that was a little crazy. But so, They drew. How did this work now? So it was 1-0. It was less. Seattle won the first. So Seattle won the first leg.
Yeah, and they lost this one.
And they lost this one. So what was the aggregate at?
I think it's 2-2, and Olympia has that away goal. So
there it is. So they won that matchup.
That's not good.
Seattle's going to have to really push the last
Well, guys, you're forgetting one thing about this. Vancouver is now only 3 points behind Seattle, and they have 2 games in hand, 2 of which are going to be against Olympia. So if you can, if theoretically, let's say, I think the Vancouver, with the lineup that they put out last night against Montreal, they get a decisive victory against Olympia. If they can go on and get a draw there, they're up 5 points to 4 with 1 game at CenturyLink for deciding the group of death. So I think you're saying, oh, Olympia could win this. I think this is exactly the result that Vancouver wanted in terms of trying to get out of this group easily.
Definitely the most beneficial for them.
So, I mean, the other thing with the other thing with, you know, Champions League in general, of the teams that are, you got to figure Seattle's not gonna get out of group. I mean, they're in a tough group to begin with. Vancouver has the upper hand on them. I don't see them getting out of group. So of those teams that are going to be left, you got to figure DC is going to get out of group. They actually don't have that hard of a path, and they don't need to win their group to get out. Right, it's the top two teams that go in.
No, it's just the top.
Just the top
it's
one.
The top one, Russ.
That's
only
right.
Three teams in the group that play
right.
4 games. Yeah,
well, they're still in a pretty darn good spot in that case. DC. So
yeah.
I don't think they have much to worry about. They've got a handy goal differential. They've got 2 wins under their belt. They've just got to, you know, kind of
another win at home, and that seals it, regardless of what they do in that second road game.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, seriously. So you have Seattle. Seattle tanking, just crap in the bed. You have DC, you have Vancouver. Who else is left?
Los Angeles Galaxy.
So they're gonna get out of group and RSL, right?
Yes, RSL.
So of the teams that are left, guys, who do you think has the best chance of actually getting through the knockout round? At this point, I know it's early. I know we're looking into the crystal ball, but you got to figure that final is going to go through Mexico again. So
yeah.
So who has the best chance?
Well, I think the Galaxy have the best team, and I think that gives them a good chance. And I think they're also the team, maybe second only to DC, with the most experience. But I think if it goes through Mexico, it's going to come down to who the better team is, you know? Because when you play in Mexico or you play a Mexico team in general, you're not having to worry about ridiculous field conditions. You're not having to worry about chippy games in front of – well, not in front of the fans, but with ridiculously chippy and divey players. You know, it's a Mexican team, so they're quality opposition. And I think L.A. has – the more dangerous players and the players that can compete with some of the top Mexican League players and the top Mexican League teams. So I think if any team is going to do it, it's going to be LA.
I'm going to agree with you on that one, Ty, but the thing that I would add here, you know, one thing that I think sometimes hurt the Galaxy in this tournament in the past, going to Mexico or going to other places, is the other team's fans would definitely show up, not only because it was the Galaxy, but because of Landon Donovan. You know, we saw a little, I've noticed it even now in a few games at LA where there's a little bit more of a buzz and a little bit more of a buzz with maybe the... Not to disparage them, but the Hispanic or the Mexican fan who is clearly a Liga M, similar to how we have Euro snobs, I would say to a much lesser extent, we have Liga MX snobs about MLS who are now more interested in the Galaxy because of Giovanni Dos Santos. So now we've got to play a second leg against Club America. The fact that Pumas are also in Mexico City is as a Pumas fan who hates Club America, who wants nothing more than them to lose, do you potentially go to that game and root for the Galaxy because you're rooting for Giovanni Dos Santos? I've got to think to a certain extent that's going to benefit the Galaxy. If nothing else, no one's throwing vomit and piss at Giovanni.
Well, hey, those aren't fun things to have thrown at you, so I bet he hopes that doesn't happen.
Yes.
But, I mean, you know, the enemy of your enemy is your friend, right? So if you go there and you don't want Club America to win, you've got an extra incentive to vote, not to vote, but to root for the Galaxy because, yeah, Gio's there. So, you know, I agree with you. Why not?
Mm-hmm. And the one thing here that I will point out that is a little bit of a benefit is looking at it, you know, we've got at least three MLS teams are going to get out. RSL has only played one match there, 1 point behind Municipal, but they have two games in hand. So, okay, I would say with certain confidence that four MLS teams are going to be out of a possible four maximum. But then you look at Group A that has Santa Laguna. They've now, their Saprissa has 6 points. They only have three, so that's an advantage. Herediano is tied with who is this? Who's UANL again? I can't remember. Oh, that's Tigres. Okay, yeah. So they're both tied on 4 points, and then Quintero is up 4 points to three on San Francisco of Panama, but San Francisco has a game in hand. So the only real, you know, four MLS teams are going to get out of it. Only Mexican team that's really distinguished themselves so far has been America. The other four Mexican teams, I could see two of them not even getting, at least one of them, maybe even two, not even getting out of the group stage. So at this point, if you're an MLS team, you know, if there's a possibility of the only thing we have to worry about is Club America in the final, I've got to be chomping at the bit.
It definitely has a different feel to it this year for sure. But, you know, with some of these other clubs from these other Central American countries, especially Costa Rica and Honduras, those are maybe even tougher places to play if you're an MLS team than going to Mexico. I mean, if not only for the travel reasons, but the conditions when you get there and the absolute toxic atmosphere of the stadium as far as the fan goes. So
you
gotta
take a bus into the jungle to get there.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Man. It's like, I don't think there is any sort of, you know, certainly not an easy route for any MLS team, but I don't think there's a comfortable route if you're a player on an MLS team through any country in the CONCACAF Champions League. It's a very, very, very difficult tournament to play in, no matter who you're playing, and no matter how, you know, small of a team they are compared to these MLS clubs. It's going to be really difficult for anybody to get through.
The C's in CONCACAF do not stand for comfort.
No. They stand for crooks
and crazy.
Crazy, more crazy than crooks. They're really trying to clean it up, to be honest. And I get that. So should we you know briefly address the comments made by the head of the committee for reform over in FIFA, or do we not want to bother?
What an upstanding man he is. What a guy who obviously stands for the growth of the game when you make comments like that. Do you think anyone doesn't know what the comments are, Ross? Maybe we should specify what those are before we go to...
Let's fill them in,
but I want to give the number first again just in case somebody wants to call in and rant about this, because I know that was my first reaction.
Oh, it's rantable.
Oh, it's a rantable. 732-707-7994. You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, of course, and only at lastwordonsports.com. Ty, why don't you tell the audience what they've won in FIFA content?
Well, they've got themselves a nice man who says that football in the U.S. I might be paraphrasing a little bit, but these are the adjectives he used. Football is an ethnic sport for girls in school in the U.S. I think that's what he said, right?
Yeah, that's the long and the short of it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much maybe a word or two off from what he said. But that is an ethnic sport, and for girls in school are the words that came out of his mouth, which not only shows, you know, a total disrespect for, you know,
just hasn't been paying attention.
Yeah, no, but he has no idea what's going on. Like, how are you going to put this guy in charge? You know, he's got a big job now, and he has no idea what's going on. So I don't think that speaks well for, you know, obviously him, but for FIFA in general and them trying to repair whatever image they have left to repair.
Has the KKK endorsed him yet?
They might as well, especially when you call it
man.
Ethnic
making
sport.
A Donald Trump joke, Ty. Just keep going.
An ethnic sport. Wow, that's not only ethnocentric, but it's a little bit freaking outright racist.
Yes, it is.
because obviously he's referring to, you know, the Latin and Central American and, you know, specifically Mexican not yep. roots, but man, what word am I looking for? They're very prevalent in the soccer landscape here, and to have him, yeah, there you go. To have him just call it an ethnic sport is pretty freaking rude. Yeah. I'm still taken aback by it. And for girls in school, how about the U.S. women's national team, full of professionals who just won the Women's World Cup, buddy? How do you think that translates?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there it is. He's not paying attention. Clearly.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, that's the original.
Clearly, isn't paying attention. And, my favorite part about all this. You know, it wasn't those comments actually. It was him talking about you know, transparency and trying to operate operating with a certain amount of transparency, but they won't. He won't tell us what he's being paid. He was asked by another individual in FIFA to lead the committee, and it wasn't Sepp Blatter, and he won't tell us who it is. You know, that really speaks a lot to the gentleman's commitment to transparency. I don't know.
Just, he's got them. FIFA, you know, as a whole has gotten them.
Well, there it is. I mean, look, we've dealt with MLS for the last 20 years, not having just about the transparency of a brick. We've talked about it all the time on the show.
They don't have malicious transparency, though. I think that's the difference, you know.
And there it is.
They're not really trying to hide anything. They just, you know, it is what it is. When you talk about FIFA, you've got, you know, $150 million of corruption and human trafficking as far as the Qatar FIFA World Cup stadiums go, and illegal labor and really malicious things, and they're being very opaque about that, whereas MLS, it doesn't really matter whether or not they're being transparent for a lot of things.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that MLS isn't trying to hide things. One of the things, and all right, so
well, I promise I wouldn't messing with people's lives is my point.
Here's an interesting piece of information for you. Remember the whole mess with Ambrose Oyongo?
Yep.
Everybody was there. Everybody remembers it. So Oyongo's playing nicely with Montreal now, and he's there, and he's doing well. He's doing exceptionally well. Here it comes. That he shouldn't have even been transferred to MLS because he wasn't a registered player with Fecafoot. He actually was playing with a semi-pro club that actually doesn't really play any games and is owned by a sports marketing firm.
Interesting.
The rumor is that the only way Anatoly Abang plays backup striker for New York Red Bulls comes from the same team. It's Rainbow Bementa FC. I think.
Yeah, they did a whole like uplifting expose on that club, did they not?
Yeah, I wrote part of it. I wrote one a while back, and Mitch Tierney from Waking the Red kind of broke the whole story on Last Word about it, and you know, I kind of dug a little bit deeper there. You know, Rainbow Bementa FC is owned by Rainbow Sports Marketing, supposedly. And again, this is total conjecture. We've talked about it. If you want to see the piece, I can dig it up and tweet it out at some point. But the deal was that the only way Oyongo could get to MLS was signing with Rainbow FC, and because the agent wouldn't deal with anybody else, some unnamed MLS agent. That's all I know And that's as far as we got with it. So there's certain, and when I asked everybody for some sort of statement on the matter, everybody was New York Red Bulls was appropriately saying, well, he's traded, and he is now needs to report to Montreal Impact. Montreal Impact said there was nothing funny going on, and Major League Soccer didn't have a comment. So, when I started digging around for it, the whole thing was very interesting.
That's a good word to use.
And I think we very nearly saw the dark underbelly of professional soccer on the international level. We saw some of that here in Major League Soccer, Give it to Don Garber and his colleagues for being able to shield us from most of the crap that goes on because of that exact thing. And here's something else, right? We talked about targeted allocation money. All of a sudden they come up with it. And we follow a league that comes up with rules on the fly with like blind draws and target allocation money. Instead of giving a fourth designated player spot, you have target allocation money so you can buy down one of your designated players. But what is that actually doing to that contract? And again, that's something else that is. Is this kind of?
Well, they're still getting paid that money.
They're still getting paid money.
It doesn't count against the cap because they're allocating that targeted allocation money towards that portion of the contract.
Okay, then why not make it just simply a fourth designated player?
Well, because you could do other things with that targeted allocation money. You could add a low level, DP kind of guy with that level. It's up to what? 500? It's 500,000?
I think it's over three seasons.
A pretty good, transfer fee or salary with that money. You could trade it. You could do a couple of things with it. So I like it because it gives clubs a little bit of flexibility that they haven't had in past years. So I think that's not really a bad rule. I think it's a rule that was kind of forced on them by the Galaxy wanting to buy Giovanni Dos Santos and MLS not wanting to say no, but not having another option as a way to say yes.
Fair enough. But I also wonder how much of it is this kind of dark.
And it's MLS, it did, immediately add $10 million to the player funding pool. So that's not a bad thing either as far as MLS commitment to
And when this rule first came out, Alec and I were a little bit critical of this on the podcast, thinking that, we're forcing teams to spend the money. I think we're now up to 12 have already used the money in some capacity. And
that's good. You want them to use that money.
Yeah, so there's 8 teams left who haven't used it, who need to use it by the end of next season. And I've got to think that they'll do something productive with it this offseason. I still agree that to a certain extent this was the let's get Giovanni to LA rule. I'm using my finger quotes here for those of you who can't see. But I guess to the Galaxy leaders, I would pose the question of, how is it that the Texas – or wow, I don't know where that came out of – the target allocation money as opposed to the Texas allocation money. How come it's the worst thing in the world and an abomination and Don Garber, stacking the deck for the Galaxy when it gets them Giovanni Dos Santos, but it's a good thing when it allows Montreal to sign Drogba? So I think, it's not without criticism. It certainly isn't a perfect rule. It did help the LA Galaxy, but it hasn't been all bad, and I think it's added several key and interesting players and players who I think could be the difference in a few MLS teams as they look to, hunt for a playoff spot and potentially make a run.
Well, so what if it did help the Galaxy get Giovanni Dos Santos? I don't think that makes it bad, and it's not like the Galaxy are the only team that gets to use this rule. So and I know, people are saying, oh, it's bad because it stacks the deck. No, what it does is it forces other teams to push themselves forward, and it forces other teams to you know, get players and build a squad in general that's on that level. And it's doable, you know, and it's doable not only with target allocation money, but with the correct spending on other players and the correct designated players coming in. So it forces front offices to make better decisions, to use their resources more fully. And in general, I think it helps push the league forward. So whether or not it helps LA get Giovanni Dos Santos doesn't make it good or bad. It just gives it gives all of the teams an opportunity to take risks and take initiatives that a lot of teams haven't been doing at all. So it kind of nudges them towards that, and I think that's why it's good.
We're going to cut the break right here because I think this is a perfect move to the next thing here. We're going to get Marty Tomczak in from Section 8. What's Section 8, you may ask? They're the supporters group that is currently supporting the Chicago Fire. And he has some words to talk about hashtag BlackoutCF97. And I find it very interesting that we're talking about front office moves and forcing teams to do better by their clubs here when we're talking about the Chicago Fire. When we come back, you're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. You can hear us on Mixlr. And by the way, if you haven't known already, the phone lines are open, 732-707-7994. Give us a call if you have something to say.
She goes in.
Welcome back to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name is Russ McKenzie. You are listening live only at lastwordonsports.com, only at Mixlr, too. I guess it's not – I can't say it's an only anymore, huh?
Nope.
Joined now once again by Matt Pollard and Ty Bailey. We got a guest tonight, a special guest from – he writes for Fire Confidential, reporting on all things pregame with Chicago Fire, and he is an active member of Section 8, both home and away, Marty Tomczak. How are you tonight, Marty?
Hi, guys. How are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Marty, just tell us, why don't we jump right in here and just tell us a little bit about what happens with, what goes on with this hashtag that's kind of taken the Chicago Fire Nation by storm here, and you know, the thoughts around it, and what is going on?
Yeah, sure. So a little bit of background. Basically, the hashtag that we're talking about is hashtag Blackout CF97, and it is not an idea that is new to Section 8. We have used this in the past as a form of protest in our early days when we were still at Soldier Field, back in 2000, I believe. After a pretty poor run of results, they blacked out the section then. We also reused it for when we were at Toyota Park and had some issues with security using racial slurs against members, Latin American members of our supporters groups. We did a blackout then. And so we've kind of reverted to this tactic when things get bad. Unfortunately, this time things got bad off the soccer field and on the soccer field as well. And so after the Philadelphia result, when we got knocked out of the Open Cup, we basically decided that we're going to revert to this tactic again. And then basically things built up and came to a spearhead. It was not just me and on the Fire and Fire Confidential that commented on this. It was a lot of buildup from fans, from across the fan base, not just Section 8. We had people chipping in from all over the stadium, season ticket holders in the club seats, season ticket holders up in the balcony. I even had phone calls of support and donations for the TIFO come in from Fire expats from California, from Toronto, from as far away as England. So basically, all of that came in the form of a protest at the home match previous to this Wednesday, which was last Saturday. And I'm sure you guys saw photos of that. So basically, that's how it started. And going forward, we'll see where the fans want to take it.
So walk us through a little bit of the issues surrounding the Chicago Fire right now that have caused you to, you know, break out the social media riot gear, so to speak.
Sure. I mean, you guys are well-versed in the happenings of the league.
Sure.
And I'm sure you know what the Fire results are like. Well, and unfortunately, that's been the case for far too long, right?
Sure.
And so as fans, we sat down and said, what is the trend? Why is this happening for the last couple of years? And basically, it's ownership and the type of running of the club that Andrew Houtman has in mind.
You know what? You know what gets me too? We've seen a number of these supporter protests, right? Recently, in the league, you know, with Philadelphia Union, you know, bringing in a coffin of Nick with a effigy of Nick Sakowitz in, and instantaneously there was a response result wise. Of course, the commitment to the U.S. Open Cup, which ran through Chicago actually, and then again, talking about the beginning of the season with New York Red Bulls, with their supporters after Mike Petke was firing, it seems to be. I don't think there's another sport anywhere that supporters have such an active voice. And you know, what do you think that's attributed to? Is it something bigger than just organizing, or is it something bigger picture here?
I think it's organizing. Oh, go ahead, Marty.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut in, but I think it's definitely a bigger picture. Personally speaking, I come from, I'm actually a Polish immigrant, right? And so back in Poland, soccer is not just a sport, right? It's a lifestyle that involves politics and religion for some people. It's an everyday part of life in a way that other sports in North America are not.
And then I was just going to say, Russ, I think a lot of it's just culturally, you know, when I don't feel this way about it, but I know a lot of supporters at various, you know, clubs where they will say, you know, don't call me a fan, or almost being offended by that term. I think the term supporter is another rung up, or it's a particular type of fanatic. And I think culturally, with the way soccer builds its stuff in there, it's such that through the organization and through the culture, supporters have a little bit more of a voice where they can do things, they can do it in an organized way, and obviously get a bigger attention of the fan base and the city market as a whole, and then obviously the front office.
Yeah, it's a different relation that supporters and the club and the front office and just the general team have. You know, it's more of an organic relationship. It's more of a grassroots kind of thing, and I think that comes even in MLS as a result of, you know, just how long the sport has been around and how it was developed, like that culture was just developed in Europe. I think it's one of the things that I'm glad was adopted by MLS supporters group and by MLS as a whole, and has had a real effect on the sport here. And I think that relationship is important because, unfortunately, when things don't really go well for the clubs, you have these movements like Blackout, CF97, and they don't fall on deaf ears.
And I think that we've seen that time and again. Marty, maybe you can refresh our memories here. The last time that Blackout CF97 was rolled out, what changes were made at that point?
This was pre Twitter days, so I don't think we had a hashtag the last time it was busted out. But the front office was shocked, and because this time around they had a little bit of heads up because of social media organizing. But back when we did it to raise awareness of what Monterey Security was doing to the Latin American fans, this silence, this wearing of black, they really didn't know how to handle it, and they were shocked. And they took it very, very seriously to the point where changes were implemented. Not necessarily entirely because of the protest, but it had a large part to do with it. And we're hoping for similar success this time around. And we've seen not direct results yet, but we've seen the front office worried again, which is great. It goes to show that, you know, supporters still do have a voice in this league. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, Marty, I've been, I don't know if you know, I was based in St. Louis a little bit earlier this year. So for the site, I was covering St. Louis FC, Chicago Fire's USL affiliate. So I was talking back and forth with Jeff, and usually there'd be a random text message or tweet aimed at me right before a game went live just to see, oh, you know, is Alec Kahn and Patrick Duty, are they starting at all? So I'm a little bit more familiar with the Chicago Fire side of things. I know some people, some fans, other people on Twitter who are calling for Frank Yallop's head, and I'd point this out. I'd ask this of the group as a whole. I think he should be on the hot seat. I don't think he should be fired after this season. I think he should be given another year to sort of implement things. He has made a few tactical changes and brought in a few players who I've been impressed with. As far as like what's causing the downfall of the team, I point to, I think Jeff had a tweet out a couple of games ago, sometime in the last month, that basically showed that Cuauhtemoc Blanco has basically single-handedly outstatted all of the other Chicago Fire DPs combined. But I would pose, what do you guys feel on that? Do you think that Frank Yallop's job is in jeopardy?
Yeah, I think so, only because of, you know, a lot of coaches get the most of the stick for the results of the club, and I think that's, you know, that's not unwarranted. But I think he gets one more year, and I think that's a good thing because he has the tools that he can put together and get a pretty good team out of it. I'm more worried about the general front office trend of bringing in the wrong designated players. I think that's more what's causing some of this problem, not only because the product in the field doesn't become any better because you got the wrong designated players in, but just the toxicity that brings when you keep trying and failing in different ways. So I think Yallop is safe for now. I don't like where the front office is.
What do you think?
I would say that I agree as far as the front office is concerned, but then Yallop becomes part of that problem, right? I'm in the camp that says that he should not be here after this year. In fact, he shouldn't have been here after the Open Cup loss. And I thought he wouldn't be. After that Philly game, I walked up to the team bus, and he looked shell-shocked, right? He was standing by the bus talking to his family, and he looked like he was a goner. But at the same time, firing Yallop is an admission to wrongdoing on Hauptmann's part, right? Because Yallop is Hauptmann's guy. And Hauptmann does not like admitting that he is wrong, right? He'll keep throwing money at a problem until it's way too late or until you forget about what the original problem was. And so I don't think Yallop is going to get fired. I think he will be here next year. As far as him and making changes and giving him more time, there's only three or four players left on the roster that were here before he got here. So he's had his time. He's had his players picked out. He's had three, four windows now to fix things in a way that show that he knows what he's doing, and he hasn't done it. As far as tactical changes, I don't think he's done anything in that department either. I mean, you saw Polster start at right back again this past Wednesday. Luckily, it worked out, but, you know, off the record speaking, Polster has said that he doesn't like playing right back to certain people, and yet it continues to happen. So, no, I don't think Yallop is the answer at all.
By the way, phone lines are open, 732-07-7994. Give us a call. We're talking to Marty Tomczak. And just, you know, talking about it, just generally speaking about the power of supporters in Major League Soccer, and specifically about Chicago Fire. I talked to Jeff often. I kind of remember him talking about Frank Yallop at the beginning of the season, and it's interesting to me to see parallels here because Frank Klopas over in Montreal isn't exactly the most popular of coaches either, and his prior job was in fact coaching the Chicago Fire. So here's the question, and I know that I'm gonna kind of give this to the floor. How does Chicago Fire fix it? It's one thing for us to sit here and say, this XYZ is wrong. So what's the solution? Matt, we'll actually go to you first.
Well, I don't think they can do much in terms of fixing things for this season. I think, as I pointed out earlier, on the whole, their DPs have kind of been failures, and I think I did not watch the video of Sean Maloney arriving at the new club that he was at in England. I'm blanking on who it was that he joined, but there was no mention whatsoever of being glad to be back in the UK and missing his family. So I question, was that sort of an excuse to try and get out of a bad situation he was in? And on a whole, I have to say, Maloney did have some good moments. He did provide some veteran leadership, as an experienced player in the Premier League, both the Scottish and the English Premier League. But on a whole, his DP tenure was a bit of a failure. And then, Akam's been on, and I could go down the list with everybody other than Cuauhtemoc Blanco for a whole. And I think, we compare that to, teams that get one or two really good DP signings. So I think the first thing is, you know, where you're spending the big money, those absolutely have to be hits and ones that you're 100% sure where you're going to get a player who's healthy, who's consistent, and who wants to be here and wants to be here for the long term that you could build the team around.
Guys, we got a caller here. I just wanted to throw it in. Oh, man, I just lost everybody else. Guys, we're going to cut the break right here. We'll be right back.
Hello?
Two issues. Houtman either needs to leave or he needs to set his pride aside and hire somebody that knows what they're doing, right? Because...
Go ahead. I'm going to add somebody to this call. Just 1 second. 313, go ahead.
Hey, this is Jeremy Whiting. Actually, I write for Last Word as well.
Hey, Jeremy.
And I just had a couple things. Hey, what's going on, guys?
Marty, sorry to cut you off there. You still there?
Yep.
Cool. Yep. Jeremy, what do you got?
Well, I just heard – I missed the last couple minutes, but I heard you guys discussing whether or not Yallop's time is up and people's thoughts on that. I had a couple things I wanted to point out that I'm not sure that a lot of casual MLS fans are aware of. So the main thing that I see, the main issue I see is that the Fire are one of the only clubs in the league without an actual president of soccer operations. Yallop is essentially wearing two hats. He's hired as both the coach and the director of soccer. So instead, in lieu of having a president to answer to, he is essentially technically sort of his own boss, working with Brian Bliss in the office. And he's gone on record multiple times saying, if there's a problem with the soccer, the buck stops at me. The problem with that is that he is also the coach. So, you know, fans, I think, are frustrated because there's sort of what appears from the outside to be a little bit of a lack of accountability within the organization. You know, the only person really above him is Houtman, who we never hear from. And Atul Khosla, the other guy, main guy in the front office, has gone on record saying that all of the soccer business basically is run by Yallop and Brian Bliss. So that's another main problem I see, is that you have a coach who's working more than one job, essentially.
Wow, yeah, that point. You can't have a soccer monarchy. You really can't. Apparently not. That kind of reminds me, though, of the Jurgen Klinsmann situation, in the way that he's not only the head coach, but he's the technical director for U.S. soccer as well. So that's another situation where, you know, recent results and some recent decisions have suggested that maybe a guy has too many responsibilities. Maybe he's in two minds because of the different jobs that he has, whether in Jurgen's case it's building for the future in the next World Cup or getting results now. As far as Yallop goes, I mean, he's got to, as the director of soccer, he's got to build that general club philosophy within the constraints of, you know, the ownership's budget and some of the decisions they want to make. But, you know, I think when you have that on your plate, that's definitely too much to go out and handle day-to-day responsibilities of winning week in and week out as a soccer coach. So I definitely think that's a problem.
Marty, what do you think?
No, that's exactly what I was saying about Houtman needing to go out and hire a president.
Exactly.
Because one of the big issues is behind the scenes, and I've heard this from multiple people that have since left the club. Basically, Houtman micromanages everything, right? And he is not a soccer guy. He's a rich LA kid that got this little play thing, and he's running it into the ground. And that's the bottom line. And so while Houtman out is a fun rallying cry, I personally don't expect him to give up his play toy, but we would really appreciate if he went out and hired people that know what they're doing. And that includes a president. It includes increasing the scouting system so that Yallop doesn't have to worry about all these things, or whoever's coach in the future doesn't have to worry about these extracurriculars. And he just needs to get it done. AK did a Q&A a couple weeks ago with fans, and he made it very clear that he runs the business side of things and Yala runs the soccer side of things.
Exactly.
I'm not as familiar with the rest of the league as you gentlemen are, but I doubt there's anywhere else in the league that has two guys in charge of all of operations of the club.
You'll love this. You'll love this when I say it. You will absolutely love this when I say it, Marty. The only other club that I know of that does it that way is Philadelphia Union. And we
comparison.
And you know, Nick Sakowicz has come out and said he's not a soccer guy. You know, he was on Soccer Morning on XM, Sirius XM, a few weeks ago, and he made a complete unadulterated fool of himself because Jason Davis. He gave him the questions beforehand. He knew the questions were going to come. The questions were going to come, and he just didn't. I don't know whether he misunderstood where the questioning was going or whatever. But he really ended up coming off like a fool, like he doesn't know what he's doing. And you know, I find it very interesting that you guys the fan protest this season was in Philadelphia. You know, and it's very interesting what Philadelphia has done recently too. The way they have it set up, they have multiple owners, right? And part of the ownership just deals with the senior team and player acquisition, and the other side of it, the actually more well funded side, deals with youth academy and player development, and Philadelphia has the Barcelona model academy with the residency and the school, and you know, you live there and you breathe soccer and you eat soccer and you dream about soccer the whole time. And they also are starting their own USL affiliate in Bethlehem. I wrote a piece on that. I wrote a piece on Bethlehem FC, you know, a week ago. So if you want to find that, I probably have tweeted it out like 18 times.
Shameless plug, Russ. Shameless plug.
Listen, what do you want? but seriously, it's very interesting to see that. Maybe, none of these players other than Zach Pfeffer have really come up and played for the senior team. Mostly, it's been a bit of chaos for Philadelphia, and now you look at that model and you see it in Chicago as well, and you see that basically the same kind of frustration with the fan base. I think it's an interesting parallel to watch. Interesting to see who figures it out first, but it kind of is. Jeremy, we're going to let you go here. Thanks for calling in, okay?
Yep, no problem.
Anyway, guys, Marty, knowing that about Philadelphia, what do you think?
I'm sorry?
Knowing that about Philadelphia, that they're doing the same kind of model that you guys are, that's going on in Chicago, and similar results, right? What do you think about that? What does that add? I suppose it would add fuel to the fire, right?
No, I mean, I think it, you know, gives credence to everything that I've been thinking about the Andrew Hauptmann ownership. It's not a coincidence that they're both at the bottom of the table.
Well, guys, I think we've come to the end of it here. Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And
thanks for having me, guys.
No worries, man. And I really hope things get better for you guys in Chicago.
Get any worse. So.
Yeah, seriously, you guys have.
It's
you guys
good
have
for the league when Chicago's good. So.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks again for having me, guys. I hope that was insightful.
Yeah,
as
man.
Far as how things are going on our end.
Yeah, definitely. Man, it was. Oh, by the way, I don't know if you listen to Extra Time Radio, but Simon Bork thinks you guys are in prime position to make the playoffs.
It's all going according to plan.
Yep. Yeah.
Anyway.
We won one game that we're in, right?
Yeah, exactly. So thank you again, Tom. We really appreciate it. And you have a great night, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
So, gentlemen, we've come to the end of it here. What game are you guys going to be watching when it comes down to it on the weekend?
Well, tomorrow night, there's only one to choose from, and I'm definitely going to watch it because I want to see Sebastian Legit outplay every designated player on the field once again, because that's always fun to do.
And true.
Yeah, and true. It's great.
Hashtag LegitJet is great. Legit.
Yeah, sure is. And then Saturday, I'll actually be in the box at Yankee Stadium, so I'll be watching the New York City FC versus Columbus Crew SC match because I don't have a choice because I will be physically at that match.
And they'll attach the Clockwork Orange face mask to keep your eyes open.
There's going to be goals, man. Like, it's not going to be an unentertaining match. It's just going to be one of those. It's going to be another one of those games where you're like, how many are both of these bad defenses going to let in? You know.
And what are you watching Sunday?
Wow. There's just so much to choose from, isn't there? Is Cascadia? Is it Cascadia on
yeah,
Sunday?
Yeah, Cascadia is the 4:30 game.
Yeah. I'm gonna watch both, man. Okay. They're on at 4:30 and 7. I got time for both.
And that timing I don't understand that timing. I don't know about you guys. I have a day job, and
on Sunday.
The game at 7 is gonna keep me out of Red Bull Arena to like 11. Anyway, so Matt, what are you watching?
Okay, well, tonight,
other than LA, San Jose, because we know what's going on there.
Okay, on Saturday, I'm looking at Toronto, Montreal, not only for playoff implications, but also just to see how both of those two teams bounce back. Both of them kind of having issues recently, so I believe that's the 4:01 derby, if I'm not mistaken. That's at 4 p.m. Eastern, and then on the nightcap, I'm really interested to see Dallas against RSL. Dallas has probably gotten a little bit unlucky with two back-to-back losses at Vancouver and home against LA, so I look for them to bounce back. Maybe Mauro Diaz is healthy, and then obviously RSL's in. You know, every single game from here on out is pretty much a must-win for Real Salt Lake. And then on Sunday, I'm watching both, but if I have to choose one that I want to watch live that I'm more interested into, I'm going to pick Seattle-Portland just because of the atmosphere. But if there's one I'm going to be more involved in, it's going to be the Atlantic Cup because I want to see you and Alec bicker on Twitter.
While everyone I'm sitting in the press box, of course.
That might be more entertaining than the actual match, if you're a neutral fan.
Yeah, no, that actually might. We've kind of calmed it down this season. We haven't been, you know, at each other.
You guys aren't doing the bet again?
No,
guys,
we're not.
You guys are getting old.
No, we're not doing the bet.
No fun allowed.
Listen. Martin Beal and I kind of had the bet at the beginning of the season. If you look back at his profile pictures, he was forced to wear Red Bull's paraphernalia, and he was very unhappy in that picture. Very unhappy about that picture. It was great. So, I'm going to watch Toronto Montreal, I think, as well, and I think it'll be the best matchup of Saturday, but it'll be the most, certainly the most fun, simply because, you know, Toronto doesn't do well against good defenses, and then the fact that Montreal hasn't really kicked it on all cylinders yet, it should be a pretty evenly matched, and the fact of the matter is it has serious playoff implications at the end of the day. I'll be at Red Bull Arena on Sunday, so I'm not going to get to see Cascadia, but I'll try to catch it in the media workroom if I can get a seat. But whatever, gentlemen, you've been on behalf of Marty Tomczak and Tyler Bailey and Matthew Pollard and the whole gang at LastWordOnSports.com. You can find Last Word SC at Podbean on iTunes. Just search Last Word Radio on Stitcher. Also search Last Word Radio. You've been listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name is Russ McKenzie. We will catch you next week. Matt, who are we having next week? We're having one of the gentlemen from Portland Timbers,
I cannot remember his name, but we are potentially having a player from Portland Timbers 2 team to talk a little bit about their USL season and the much like the MLS, the USL Western Conference is very much an arms race. And then we're also possibly going to have Matt Jordan, general manager of Houston Dynamo, to talk everything Kubo and Forever Orange.
That's going to be an excellent show. Tune in next week, only here, lastwordonsports.com. My name's Russ McKenzie. Good night and good luck.